The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am pleased to welcome back our guests. I'm going to do something I don't usually do. I'm going to read the words of an editor, Phillips editor, who I've probably known for more than two decades. And he recently left Random House, PRH, the Leviathan. His name's Paul Slovak, and he just had such a great way about him. He still does. And he never steered me wrong with an author. So if Paul said somebody was worth having, I knew it was true. Dear reader, you are about to embark on an extraordinary journey. This sweeping debut literary novel by award-winning poet Philip B. Williams is one of the most ambitious and accomplished works of fiction that has ever crossed my desk. One of the things that makes ours so singular is the way it melds the historical with the magical. Philip has told me that Black American stories demand length and mythology, and you are going to find yourself dazzled by the way this novel unfolds. Each of its many remarkable characters must figure out what it means to be free, make their own decisions, discover their fullest selves, and seek and create beauty. In short, it deals with the most fundamental aspects of human life. It has been said that poets write the best novels. Philip's poetry has won acclaim for its formal inventiveness, its lyricism, its exquisite attention to detail and language, and its perceptive treatment of selfhood, anger, and love, all of which are in full flower here. Ours is a profound work of imagination, an expansive story of redemption, power, and humanity, and I am beyond excited to share it with you. I share Paul's sentiments. I also want to let you know that Philip tonight will be interviewed by former Philadelphia Poet Laureate and poet Ara D. Matthews. Please welcome our guests.
How you doing?
Hey.
So I'm going to read all of chapter one. Don't worry, it's like three pages. And then I'll jump around. I won't be up here long because I want to talk to my G over there. Okay. Chapter 1, Blood and Light. Nearly two centuries before, the boy who was shot dead at the intersection of First and Bank stood up in his own blood and spoke his name as if it were just given to him. There was a town named Ours, founded by a mysterious and fearsome woman right where the boy had been shot. But perhaps this story begins centuries before then, at the muddy waters of the Apalachicola River, or further back on a ship named the Divider, carrying those misunderstood to be the future of slavery to the Western world. To begin in any of those three places would lead back here, to this boy, age 17, fresh out of his junior year in high school, a bottle of orange Fanta rolling and emptying onto the street just feet away from his body, from which blood spilled until it stopped, until the boy with his closed eyes opened them with a new mind and breath and understanding that shook him. He had been lying in the middle of the street for 3 hours with police tape squaring him off from his neighbors, friends, and family. The whole hood had rocked at the sound of the bullets popping off. Then he dropped and they all gathered, hemless and weathered, to see yet another one of their youngest take his last breath. But he stood, his wounds no more than memories as he touched himself where he had been shot. A resonance of pain still there until it too departed, and the smell of burnt cornbread in the air that someone had abandoned so that he wouldn't have to lie there for hours alone. Yes, they had all left something behind to stand in that street together, blocked off from touching him and told to back up. had it yelled at them as though they were to have as little care and consideration for the boy as the ones who had shot him. He dusted himself off and looked around at the faces looking back at him. "What the fuck, my nigga?" peeling from a mouth astounded into a beautiful circle. The whole block went quiet except for that question, and the loud suddenly sparked up in the crowd despite the cops right there. But who could give a fuck now when the dead have arisen? And he heard his name screamed from someone in the crowd, the voice bright and familiar. But a part of him didn't recall exactly who had said it. He had two minds now, one in the future and one from the past. To begin this journey, move backward. The boy's body returns to the hot asphalt, the orange soda slides back into the bottle, and the blood back into the boy's warming body. Then the boy's corpse rises, and the bullets spin out from the right lung, the neck, the back of the head, the left hamstring, the right buttock, the right triceps, the left scapula, his corpse becomes a living him, as flecks of bone restructure and re-enter the red-black wound, the broken, wet, resealed, the white meat sucked back into unbroken muscle, uncooked fat. And closing behind the retreat of the backward-flying bullet, the air the bullets once displaced returns from the curve of its displacement. The silver bullets return into the black gun like an unspeakable organ moving back into its dark element. The explosion of gunfire now the sound of wind hissing, then roaring, then suddenly silent. And the brown finger lifts from its trigger. The boy with his back to the police as the Fanta rises back into his pocket. And further back, weeks ago, the boy is asleep in bed and a small circle of light leaves his body. The legend begins where that light leads. At the end, the boy may teach you his name. This next section is the town has already been founded. There is a new generation born free in ours. And so these are two of the characters, Justice and Luther Phillip. At this point, they are about 9 years old. There had been a tornado, and the boys wanted to see the damage left in its wake and the distraction of the calamity it left behind. Roofs peeled back, farm animals needing calming, flattened vegetables and upturned plants scattered all over the roads. An entire wagon rolled and tipped a half mile out, needing to be turned right side up again and returned to its owner. The boys made their escape. Needing desperately to play farther from town, they decided to hike north toward Delacroix. In the distance, a tree taller than all the others fanned its full leaf expanse and blocked out everything behind it. They had wanted to journey farther, but what this walk lost in distance, it made up for in inscrutability. The tree, a master of silhouettes, cast shadows that haunted and pierced the earth beneath it. The lower branches never had many leaves to begin with, the bottom half sharp with death, but the branches higher up were thick with green and activity. Justice thought he heard a voice coming from the tree, but the sound had a pinprick to it, small enough that it had to have come from a specific spot in the boughs. He stood a good distance away from the tree and listened to the voice while watching Luther Phillip climb up and away from him. Seeing the lack of hesitation in Luther Phillip's climb sparked envy and Justice, and he didn't know why. Climbing trees came easy to Justice. Nothing to it if you can get on that first branch. But fear stopped him from following, and the voice he feared in the tree had no effect on Luther Phillip, who touched the rough bark and pulled himself up without mentioning the whispers peeling from the trunk. "Come on up," Luther Phillip called, but Justice stayed speechless on the ground. Finally, he asked, "You don't hear that? Luth, you don't hear that?" Luther Phillip kept climbing. The boy didn't hear the whispers or his friends shouting up to him, and if there ever existed a loneliness so unique that it required another name, Justice had found it. Justice looked up. Luther Phillip appeared to levitate in the tree. He had perfected his stillness such that he blended in with the surroundings, and Justice lost him in the leaves. The tree and Luther Phillip became the only two things in the world, and now they had become one, leaving justice to watch on the outside, a spectator to his own friendship. Walking around the tree, peering through the leaves to find Luther Phillip, justice called up to him but heard no response and saw no movement. Justice crept closer to the tree and the tree voice sighed. Bad enough that Luther Phillip left justice alone with some ghost in the leaves, but now Luther Phillip hid from his friend, tainting the beauty their silence once carried. You can stay your coon ass up there for all I care. You can stay up there and die. Still no response. As quick as his rage had built, fear had taken over. He stepped closer to the tree, and the tree voice he heard fell away. As he began to climb, he strained to hear it again, to make out the tree's words smothered by the wind. Was it male or female, somewhere in between, or a wholly new kind of being? Did he hear smoke in the voice, a bit of honey? He started to miss the voice as a kind of accompaniment to his sudden loneliness, which told him that being afraid of the unknown felt a little better than fearing having no one to share the unknown with. Justice climbed the other side of the tree, bark scratching against the bark-like skin on his play-rough knees. He made it to where Luther Phillip stood frozen in the branches and crossed over several more branches to get closer. Luther Phillip was staring at something caught in the corner of two limbs, meeting at the trunk. Justice tried to find the source of his friend's distraction. Eye level between them set a nest, wiry and black, with the rocks spread out in the dark strands. Tears dripped down Luther Phillip's face like rainwater from a shattered window. He breathed short, quick breaths, and Justice didn't understand. Why are you crying? Justice asked. He stood a bit further from the nest than Luther Phillip. A foul smell caught his nose. Luther Phillip didn't answer, his attention unbroken. Justice leaned in and finally understood what he had gotten wrong. The nest was made of hair with pieces of scalp still attached, and the tiny rocks were human teeth, some with just dried blood still at the root. A few maggots squirmed throughout, making the teeth dance faintly in place. Just above the hair nest, impaled into the tree, were more teeth, the tornado having whipped them into the trunk. A breeze jostled the side of the nest and the stench rose up like fire. We need to get down, Justice said. You hear me? We need to get down.
Thank you all for being here tonight, and thank you especially, Phillip, for writing ours. You know, from one writer to another, it is so hard to give birth to a thing, you know, to conceive of it, to plan it, to actually have it come out of your hand in some way, shape, or form. And I think about authors who are, there are authors who write literary works, that's true. But there are also authors who perform literary feats. And so I want to say what you did with ours is in fact a literary feat. You were able to combine so many different concepts in a way, threading them throughout so that we could see both the past, the present, well, equally the past, the present, and the future. Mm-hmm. So it was just really beautiful moment, and I just want to give you the opportunity to get your flowers.
Thank you.
So everybody, if you haven't read the book, it's absolutely incredible. And to Paul's letter, it is a sweeping novel. So it spans over 40 years, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of thought, I imagine, that has to go into that, but there's also a lot of experience. So I was wondering if you could tell us what in your formative landscape mm-hmm. as the writer helped to shape your thoughts about history, mythology, or your interest, history, mythology, African traditional religions. What spurred you in that direction?
I blame everything on my mama. It's her doing, and it started with there being readily available to me resources that were mythological, spiritual. She was a horror film buff, and I used to be able to watch them with her. I can't watch them now. My blood pressure. I can't do it. I get anxiety. Or sometimes I can see what's going to happen because they have a formula to them, a lot of them do. But yeah, it was me being allowed to imagine more than what was there, or to imagine differently what was already there. Mm-hmm. Because she also had stories of how she, you know, would have these prophetic dreams, or there's even a story in the book that she told me about her father that deals with him, you know, salting his thresholds.
Right.
And there's someone who's coming to visit his sister, and he's like, you know, she's out, but you can come in. And she motions like she's going to go in, and then she stops. She's like, no, I'll just wait on her. I'll wait for her.
No, thank you.
And he said, it's hot. It's blazing outside. Come on in. I got some water, whatever. She said, no, I'll wait. She would not cross the salted threshold. So what was going on with her? Mm-hmm. And so there's always been that combination of, or that, not even a combination, there's always been the reality of there's more to what our experiences are. And so for me, it was nothing to embed all of those mm-hmm. mythological, folkloric, historical mm-hmm. moments. Mm-hmm. And I don't see a difference from myth and history. I see they have two different uses, mm-hmm. or they can be, or two different expresses of similar concern mm-hmm. in that way. So mm-hmm. it was something that I was just raised to do.
It's kind of interesting because, just exactly as you said, myth and history are kind of the same. Mm-hmm. The only difference is that history is authored by victors, right? Myth are things that are handed down to the people,
right?
To govern the people, to help to make things orderly in some sort of way. And speaking of that, I wanted to talk about literary traditions, okay, or modes is probably a better word to think about it. Mm-hmm. So we had this conversation. He and I talked a little bit this weekend, and
we cheated.
Well, he's my homie, so I'm going to talk to him anyway. We talked a little bit about the modes that were working inside the book, the levels of the modes. And so I said to you, this feels very much in the tradition of Black magical realism. Mm-hmm. And then you pushed back on that a bit and you said, no, it's Black surrealism. Mm-hmm. And hear me out, is it possible that they're cohabitating together? And maybe that's what the literary feat is, because it's really hard to have two traditions or two modes inside mm-hmm. of the same book. So you've got the surrealism in that you've got sort of these ideas around underground subculture. Mm-hmm. You've got radical reimagining of space. But then you have the magical elements because they're tied to land, and that's mm-hmm. real. And they're tied to family, and those concepts feel real. What, for you, steers you toward toward Black surrealism?
I am steered toward Black surrealism in as much as it's the sir of the yeah. of the realism.
Yeah.
I see that surrealism is a space of maximum dreaming and possibility, where what someone's experience is in the real is incompatible with the way they're experiencing their reality. Mm. And so just by imagining an alternative or something elsewhere or other, that is an act of surrealism. Mm-hmm. And so magical surrealism, for me, is just a very strict definition mm-hmm. of a people. And I think there was a debate on social media, which is the worst place to have a debate about.
Terrible.
It's a terrible place to have a debate.
Nobody's listening.
About what magical realism sources historically are. And there was a strong point that someone said it's part of the Latinidad. But then there are also African writers who,
sure,
you know, have what they would, many of us would consider magical surrealist moments.
Of course, yeah.
And so the counter argument was it's not just about a political moment of Latino-based writing, but of colonized people. What we are here is not necessarily a color. We are transported, vestibulic people. We're stuck in a kind of way.
Right.
And so for me to consider us to be magical realists, I think we would have to be in our original land, reconciling with the interruption of someone else's presence. Mm-hmm. But that's not exactly what we're doing here. Mm-hmm. What we're doing here is trying to reimagine a completely new life outside of an original land, mm-hmm. for those who are not Black indigenous, because there are also folks who look like us who are already here. I'm not part of that. I did my DNA test. I'm not part of that. So Black surrealism for me is more so the act of someone who's Black embodied, who's imagining what else is possible because the real does not serve them. And so I told you that there was a scholar. I still didn't look up his name. I told you I was going to look up his name. But he was at WashU. This is years ago for an MLK conference. And he's making the argument that Martin Luther King Jr. was a black surrealist because he kept saying, I have a dream. And surrealism and dreams go hand in hand.
Sure.
But to him, even though he knew he was stepping outside of what is an experienced reality, there was still potential for that to override what was, you know, considered to be real. So I lean more towards black surrealism.
Yeah. I mean, that point that you made about magical realism and that it could be magical realism if we're in our indigenous land. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's the surreal.
Yeah.
Because nothing, everything is out of whack. That's brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
No, it's real. Like, seriously. I mean, because we didn't get that far in the conversation when we were talking this weekend, but I think that is absolutely true. And in one of the things that we see, and it's really based on culture, based on what we know, is how layered and complex your character depictions are, mm-hmm. right? So when you're reading this text, I mean, as I was reading, I was like, oh, I know that person. Mm-hmm. Do you know? And I mean, I'm a century and a half beyond that, but I know that person. And there's something in it that made us be able, as a reader, to be able to relate to these people. They felt like family. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you a little bit about how you hew out the character, the complexities that the characters were dealing with, and made them, I mean, that feels magic to me. How did you make them feel so real?
You have to love them. I love them. And I think of them as tools to tell a story. There was a lot of channeling. I say half of me wrote the book and the other half was ancestral intervention. But there isn't a single character in the book that I did not fully want to throw myself in front of to defend them if something were to happen to them, mm-hmm. even when I disagreed with them. And oftentimes I disagree with them not even knowing their intention, because as I was writing the book, I was learning about them as they were learning about themselves. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know why some of the characters were so furious or some were so lonely or some were so easy to fall in love with a person they just met. I just knew that they trusted me to tell the story. I would pace back and forth and ask the question, are you sure you want to do that? Okay, I'm going to write it. You got to deal with it later. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, in that way, a spiritual connection. And then two, I would do research in order to know how I could lie. I didn't do research to tell the factual truth. I wanted to know what I could manipulate and still be realistic. Mm-hmm. And there were when the depression happened, they were trying to get people to get the jobs back, and they were going out and interviewing those who had history of enslavement, those narratives mm-hmm. that I read some of those. And I wanted to say that they were the truth, but the way they were written, they were still distilled through a white imagination or a white interlocutor. But some of the things that they were saying, I just saw the parallel to some of the things that we were experiencing here as far as what do you call a home? What does it mean to be displaced? What does it mean to have trusted someone who was supposed to take care of you and they didn't do that. Mm-hmm. So I think what is convincing about them is that even though historically, yes, we're very far off from that experience of enslavement, but our concerns are just put in different locations. So no, we don't have enslavement, but we have the prison industrial complex.
Exactly.
So it just has transformed into something else.
Right.
So it doesn't, for me, it doesn't feel too mysterious that there's resonance with someone from the 1800s when what they were experiencing has just metamorphed into something else.
Yeah. There is like this spirit of carcerality that rolls through it. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that has to do with how you juxtapose the themes, specifically freedom with constraint. Mm-hmm. We also talked about this. So you guys are going to get the benefit of our conversations that we have when we just kick it. We talked about there's something about freedom in ours where it doesn't feel totally free. And what, in your opinion, is that factor? What is it that holds them back from feeling totally free? There's still that constraint.
There are a lot of things, yeah. I mean, one is, and I got this from Percival Everett. We were having a discussion similar to this. It was three parties, though. And something he was saying is there's freedom, but then there are rights. And so you can be as free as you want, but if you're in a system that is saying these are your rights and these aren't your rights, then the expression of freedom is already going to be curtailed in that particular, whoever is morphing the laws, right? So to want to be able to say, I am free, but you don't have access to land to farm or garden, then what are we describing? So free in this category, free is reliant on someone, some power, some force saying, yes, you can do that thing that will deepen your definition of freedom or deepen your allowances toward that. So that's one moment. Another idea that I have is that freedom always has a price, because I think, and particularly now, we think of freedom as our individual ability to make individual choices, as opposed to an individual choice influencing positively the world and the people around us. And so what they're experiencing is not having had any freedom or having lost the memory of previous freedom, depending on their age, right, and when they came across the Middle Passage, and having to find definitions of that that don't disrupt other people. And that's really challenging for them.
Yeah.
It's really challenging for them, and some more so than others.
Yeah.
And so the power differential, the ability to exploit and manipulate other folks is one of the unpredictable factors, because they never had that kind of power before, except for maybe one or two people,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where freedom gets dangerous, is when it's always, I want to do this thing without any regard to those who are also wanting to do their thing. So how do you have a freedom that's collaborative or communal?
Yeah. Yeah, the imposition of the will, right?
Right.
Yeah, so, and we see that with Saint.
Yes.
I think we see it with other characters too, but we particularly see that with Saint. But before I get to Saint, I wanted to ask a little bit about time, because Saint is a part of this question.
Mm-hmm.
So time is moving in a very interesting way. So we know that the novel spans 40 years.
Yes.
Yes. Right? Right?
Right.
Yes. So we know that it's spanning roughly 40 years. But there's something interesting that's happening with time, and I think you show it through there's really no main character, is
right.
the other thing, right? So you have a menagerie of characters.
Mm-hmm.
The main character is really, to me as a reader, it was ideas around freedom and constraint. That felt like the main character, right? And we see it with the conjure that's gone wrong,
mm-hmm.
which is a whole nother thing. We should actually have that conversation.
Yeah, we can talk.
The conjure that's gone wrong. But back to time. We're going to do that later. We see two characters in which time is moving in an interesting way. For Saint, it feels like she's sort of deprived of the ability to look back. And Selah feels like she is granted the ability to look forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so how pivotal was it to have these two characters? Because it helps you move through time. You move through time through the characters. So how pivotal was it to have those two characters where one is searching for the past and one is searching for a promise?
Yeah.
How did that help you to navigate the way that you span time in the novel?
Well, I want to add Francis to the conversation.
Francis, too, of course.
Because Francis is the gateway for Saint to get back to the past. What Saint wants to do, at least in my interpretation, mm-hmm. is stay where she is. So she's more, for me, a representation of the present.
Interesting.
She's like, don't go out there. You stay here. You're safe here. I don't need to go back to the past. The past keeps creeping up on her, but she doesn't have access to
right.
it, and we don't know why. We
right.
don't know why she's stuck there. And then Selah comes, and Selah's doing her thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, because again, I didn't know they were going to do any of these things, but as I was writing it, I don't know if it's necessarily how they collaborate in that way. I could think of that, but I don't want to BS you. It was more so, what are the individual needs of the plot line through past, present, future. Mm-hmm. And so to show that the experiences of the past have to be integrated with the present so that the future can be better understood. And so each character in that way is allowing for the reader to see, hopefully, that that bridge is absolutely necessary to live a full life. Because if you're stuck in the past, then you become obsessed with the past. If you're stuck in the present, then you're afraid forever. And if you're stuck in the future, then there's a way where loneliness and disengagement and distancing and coldness is part of your personality.
Yeah.
And so all of them had an obsession with escaping. It's just that in Saint's case, her way of escaping was resisting either.
Yeah.
Either notion. And so I wanted there to be that plot line that says you need to integrate all three in order for there to be any concept of time.
Yeah.
And that also the looping of that as opposed to a linearity is definitely more compatible with at least my Black understanding of you know, how we move through the world.
Right. And there's also something that you did structurally that was interesting, how you looped the first chapter in. Mm-hmm. The first chapter is looped into the 27th chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So as you're reading, you've got a sensibility that we're going to come back to this story.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that the way that time is going to move in the piece, it's not going to be linear, right? Time isn't even linear in real life. It's curved.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know that there's going to be some curve that's going to take you back to chapter one.
Yeah.
How, when you were conceiving of this, how did you, I know that you said it came to you like a little bit at a time, but you know, when you, did you write chapter, you didn't write chapter one first.
No.
What did you write first?
Chapter, something I ain't even in the book no more.
It got cut out?
It's a lot of stuff that just didn't make it.
Yeah.
But the earliest chapter that is still there would be chapter two. I think the majority of that was
okay, so chapter two. So then you came back and wrote chapter one, and then you wrote chapter 27 at some point.
At some point.
Subsequently, right?
Right, chapter one interrupted one of the teenage chapters.
Interesting. Did you know that you were going to come back to it? Because you were saying that the story was beginning to unfold, but did you know that it would come back? It would loop back in.
Yes, I don't like for things to be incomplete. That's why everybody's plot lines are completed. You know this. Everybody's plot lines are done. They're solved. Solved, I mean. Because I don't like experiencing cliffhangers that are, oh, yeah, that's just part of the plot. Absolutely not.
That's interesting.
No, I loathe that. Because there's still a way for there to be resonance without completely solving the thing, concluding the thing. But if you introduce something, babe, you got to talk about it.
Uh-huh.
And so I knew that having, especially when I made the promise that, excuse me, the book is set in the 1800s, but it opens in the 2000, whatever, whatever.
Right.
People are going to ask, what happened to that boy?
Right. And I'm like, he's going to come back around.
He has to come back around. Yeah. Otherwise, it feels gimmicky. And I don't
Did you know how you would get there, though?
I figured it out sooner than I thought I would.
Okay.
I figured out, I knew, I don't know when I knew because I don't have, I didn't document that process, but around the time when Selah was figuring out what was going on with her, I was like, that's how we can do it.
Yeah.
That's how we can do it. They're these twins, Selah and Naima. And there's just a way that, and this isn't a spoiler, Selah very openly can.
Don't spoil it.
It's not a spoiler.
Okay.
As soon as you introduce them, Saint's like, she does this and that one does that.
Okay.
You
okay.
Know? So, and this isn't even like what they do. So Selah's good at healing people, and Naima's good at making people sick.
So they work together.
And so
as a
they
team.
Work together as a team. So yeah, as all of that unfolded, I started to realize maybe that is the portal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way to do it.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about your lyricism?
I guess. I'm just trying to find.
I think we can't help but to talk about it, right? Because the way this book reads, and I truly believe that the best books of prose.
Oh, don't say it.
I'm gonna go get mad. I don't care. The best books of prose have elements of poetry in them,
mm-hmm.
right? The lyricism, the dexterity with language. And you demonstrate that. I mean, we already knew you gave us two books of poetry before. So you gave us Thief in the Interior and Mutiny. And here we have Hours as your first novel. And I mean, I was just dumbstruck by the language, right? So the question is, how do you work in the liminal space between those genres? Do you believe that there's a difference between the genres? And how do you work in that liminal space? What do you pull in from poetry into the novel? What do you pull in from prosaic writing into the poem?
Well, that's why I can't write essays, because I can't get out of the lyrical moment. People are always like, can you explain this thing? Can you talk about it? It's like, no, I can't.
Nope.
Leave me alone. Go find a historian or a journalist to do that work. But part of the request is, they think they're requesting one thing, but what they're requesting is an act of imagination that they don't get from other kinds of writing. But they won't allow me to do what I do naturally, which is just sing. I sing, and that's the first thing that I want to do. More than anything else, more than telling a story, more than writing a poem, I just want to make a musical line, a musical sentence. So for me, there's a difference in the genres. Poetry has its place, fiction has its place, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to be distanced in their execution. Mm-hmm. I believe in beauty, old school that way. Like,
are there any lyrical moments in here that are your favorites?
Yeah, I think that if I read it, it might be the last thing I can do. But there is a chapter that, what is this? That's 11. So chapter 10 has a really beautiful moment where they're on the water, the frozen water, and there's a way that the water is described, and that journey that they're taking is described. And I can very quickly.
No, please. Read that. Please do.
The river promised to become a solid mirror as its luminescent spectra crystallized over the water. Crossing over the upper slush, Joy's silence melted into a warm hostility. She sat cross-legged in the center of the raft and emoted. If they hit a rough patch of ice, she cut her eyes at Francis. If Francis sneezed, she sucked the roof of her mouth. And then just before that, there's the journey across a split in the earth called the Mississippi River was a kind of merging of the land itself that slushed in the silted and muddy waters as though to keep a promise that it would indeed reunite those two sides of the United States, where like a plague, colonizers ravished the land in utter disregard of those who had been there prior, those who in the wake of Europeans vanishing before their eyes to become this new thing altogether called white, found themselves diseased with smallpox and scriptures, overhunting and a greed made manifest a living haunting that reshaped and voided out forests more ancient than them all and possibly older than the river, wide-hipped and unenchanted, which is all to say, save the three of them, there was no life there. And that's just one sentence.
So it's beautiful. Yeah.
That's the way to.
Yeah. Did you find yourself needing to break habits that you had in poetry as you were writing the prose?
No, I found that I was subconsciously breaking out of that, and I wanted to stay in that.
You wanted to stay.
So I had to keep reminding myself that I can merge these two, they don't have to be separated.
Right.
And I wanted to do that.
Right, right. As you were reading that, I just got this other question in my head about freedom and what it carries. There's something on the other end of the conjunction, freedom and. And I think what we get from the Umi is that freedom also carries grief.
Oh yeah.
Why? Philosophically, why do you think that is?
Oh, I'm not Heidegger or anything. Let's see. Let me just make up some philosophy.
No, you're Philip B. Williams. Come up with your own theory. You got it.
No, I think it goes back to that individuation or individualizing moment where if your way of identifying or feeling free is in the ego, then what you're constantly grieving is the self, because that's not free. And so freedom keeps trying to steer you away from ego. And the ego keeps saying, no, this is what freedom is. It's you alone. Mm. And so if you have freedom here and you have self here, there's always going to be grief on both ends because you're not reaching either destination. You know, even if you're like more ego driven, to be completely ego is, you know, that's not even. Mm. We're talking about devastation in that moment. But there's something about being completely free that might be dangerous. But you can't vacillate. You have to know either you're going to do what you have to do to be communal and share that space, or you're not going to care about other people. So I think and this actually might be answering the question, I think where we are is on either extreme, where we can be self-sacrificing and only doing things for the community and letting ourselves fall to the wayside,
right.
Or we're all me, 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 it's about me. And what we need to do is be in the center. And saying, I have this for you because I've gotten this for myself. So there's always a constant sense of grief because you're sometimes going to lose community and sometimes you're going to lose that individual.
Mm-hmm. What character in your mind navigates that best?
Oh, that's Abba. That's Abba. He makes a decision that lasts for as long as it needs to. And even in that decision, he still figures out a way to be communal. Mm-hmm. I think he does it the best in that. Everyone else, it takes them a lot longer to figure it out.
But about
Abba,
Aurora?
I think, got it.
What about Aurora?
Well, Aurora's already there. Aurora's already there. Foster's already there. Rain's already there. But as far as like those characters who we see the majority of, mm-hmm. I would say Abba do that. Yeah.
Abba's a beautiful character. And I think through, well, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but through a specific relationship inside of the text, you begin to see love is indomitable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't matter what happens on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Love is indomitable. It doesn't matter how many times the conjure has gone awry. It doesn't matter that you may feel constrained in some way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like the idea that love still blossoms inside
the strangest places.
The strangest places.
Yeah.
You know? And so we see it with like Joy and Abba, and then you see it with Naima and Selah.
And Thylias.
And Thylias. Mm-hmm. And then you see it. I actually think you see it in parts with Saint and Francis,
mm-hmm.
and then Saint and Sebastian.
Mm-hmm.
So you just see how love carries through. It's like the through line through trauma,
yeah.
through mishap, through human fallibility. It's just there. So just thank you for writing that. I mean,
thanks for reading.
That's what's up.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
What y'all want?
Yeah, what y'all got? Questions from the audience.
I was going to just project, but, you know, this works too. So is this a story where, like, all of the characters, like, their end game is to see where they are on that spectrum you described?
End game. I don't know what end game means, particularly in a novel. I will say, I think I can answer your question without trying to change the question. I think what all of the characters have opened to them in the book is now that you are either free for the first time or you are born into freedom, but you don't have, this microphone doesn't like me, but you don't have an example of it because your parents can't teach you, you know how our parents teach us a kind of responsibility of freedom. It is a book of, I don't know how many characters are in there, let's say 20 people on their own journey to discover what can I do with my life. Now that it is mine, in a way that I would describe as in totality. I can worship how I want, who I want. I can love who I want. I can live where I want, but then that's where the plot starts to come in. Can they really? Because in order to live where they want, they have to have safety outside of the place that is ours, but then ours wouldn't have to exist to begin with. And so the entire novel is within the group, how do individuals figure out, because now they have the possibility to do that, how to be free. So yes, within that spectrum, and some people go way out on one end and way out on the other. Some people we don't even really know, or I don't really know, if they ever really evolve. There's some characters who they pick their moment and that's what they do. But to be allowed that space to not be a good person too, to have their sins and say, I'm gonna sit in because I couldn't do it before. Or I'm a sin-in because there is no one to tell me that this was wrong. Mm-hmm. So that's really the scope of how the characters are explored. Mm-hmm. Is that helpful?
That's perfect.
Okay.
How you doing?
Hello.
I got a quick question. What you were just saying about that, like your parents, your life about you not being, how can I say this? It's like being in control of everything. Do that hinders with you? Like you were saying something about your anxiety and stuff like that. Like, are you like a trauma person? Like
a trauma, suffer, like a
trauma victim? Do you suffer like
oh,
from?
I got you.
Do you suffer from that?
That's a big question to be asking somebody.
No, I was just listening for the thing that you was going off. Not nothing personal. I'm just like trying to get a quick understanding of the author. That's all.
I think, you know, I don't know if you're going to like this answer. I think we all have experienced some form of trauma. Now, whether it be money trauma, familial trauma, sexual trauma, trauma, education trauma, gender trauma, like there is a way where I think we've all been affected to some degree, whether we recognize it or not, of something having happened to us and there being a part of us stuck there,
right?
And really, trauma, in my definition, I'm not a psychiatrist, is being stuck in a pain, right. You know, revolving in that same pain. So, I mean, my answer is going to be yes in several ways. But I think what has helped me is to have, my mom who's like, what do you want to do? And have, you know, someone like D, like, I'm here. What are you trying to create? You know, to have, you know, you here being like, tell me about, like, just to have a curiosity about my life and that living. So, yeah, the answer is yes.
Another question.
Yeah.
Do you feel free now? Do you have a control of your life?
Ooh, that's a
question.
That's a question. And somebody like, well, do you feel free? No, I'm not just In some ways, I do. And in some ways, I am extraordinarily privileged. Like, you know, just sit here, I've written this book, and somebody wants to, you know, interview. That's a privilege to do that. It's also a way where I know that when I step outside, I can tell, because of trauma, people's energy, because I've had to be able to do that to survive. That don't feel good. That doesn't feel like freedom, you know? So, yeah, I am going to say sometimes I feel free. Sometimes that caged bird is not singing. Okay. And that's okay, too. Mm-hmm. But I would like to know, in Nina Simone's definition of freedom, which is no fear. So, no, I don't know that. Not yet.
Yeah. Hi, I just wanted to say, this is my first time hearing of your work, but I had seen an ad about your book on Instagram, so the algorithm is working. but I wanted to ask, could you talk more about the relationship between, like, Afro-surrealism and dreams?
Oh, yeah. So the way that I've been thinking about it, what I think my life project is leaning toward, I can say gonna be, but then I step outside of that and everybody be mad at me. So what I'm thinking about now is, what does it mean to write contemporary African-American mythology? Because in our moment, we have not, everything was industrialized or industrializing, and then there was the Age of Enlightenment, which ruined a lot of stuff. So the intellectual program of this is history, and also what is historicity, meaning who controls history, who tells it, and how do they tell it. Those are not always storytellings that I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. And I think what has helped many indigenous cultures is that they were able to create stories that to us may seem outlandish, but to them secured them in a spiritual way, outside of saying I'm Abrahamic or even the ATRs, African traditional religions, because those are sometimes considered myths now, but those are not myths. People are still worshiping in that regard. Mm-hmm. So for me, it is not necessarily making it into a religious question, but a question of, if we continue to rely on history and history has not supplied us with questions, then can imagining in the surrealistic vein, in the dream vein, alternatives or different ways of being be useful? So that I lean toward mythology in that way. So the act of dreaming of something different than what we have is already both counter to and a counterproduct of historicity. Like, it's incompatibility that we have to deal with. And my way of dealing with it is going through the dream, which I'm also conflating with mythology.
Hi. Wonderful. Just listening to both of you talk, so thank you for that. But my question is really, I mean, you kind of talked about how your mother gave you the tools to do this, but, like, what are the things that made you want to write a novel, and what are kind of the things that writing a novel is gives to you, that writing poetry? Yeah, and I know you're not seeing them as totally distinct things in the way that you write, but just kind of what did that bring to you that is a little different than the works of poetry that you've written?
Space. It gave me space and a lack of restraint, or restraint in a different way. I felt more free. I felt more free. Boo! Get off the stage! And I felt more flexibility in writing the novel, then the way I think about poetry is like scientific almost. I don't need that. It's true though, you know. It's very measured, very precise. Even when it looks a mess, I know exactly what I'm doing or trying to do. But with fiction, it's like I have no idea where I want to go. I still had the craft elements down, but I wasn't trained in fiction, so I don't have habits built. In poetry, I have so many workshops. I teach poetry. My master's degree is in creative writing in poetry. The fiction's like, I can do whatever I want because I don't know the rules. Which isn't, don't do that. Learn the rules. You got to figure it out. I learned the rules more organically, which is through reading a lot of fiction as opposed to being in a classroom and having that experience with dissecting in that way. With fiction, I was allowed to not, I didn't have an outline. I tried to have one, but I kept leaving it. So it didn't work. So every time I wrote a chapter, I was just building off of what came before and hoping that it worked. And the way that my agent was getting the novel was serially, as though it were in a newspaper or a magazine. I was like, well, here's chapter two. He's like, all right, what's next? And so, all right, I was like, here's chapter three. For 4 years, I was doing that, you know. And it took 16 years to do the total project. With poetry, I can write a book of poems in 2 months. And it's not because it's easy, but it's because the way I think about it is very different. A lot of the times I write poems in my head. I'm not even using a page. So by the time I get to the page, just spin them out. I cannot do that with fiction. So yeah, it's just a different experience.
And I'm going to brag on you because you actually did just write a book of poems.
I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. I mean, in 2 months. I'm just bragging on you. You just did that. Like the next book that comes out, he's already written it. So
it's done.
Says everything about your work ethic. We can take just one more question.
Elijah. You can ask me at home. What do you do?
So what's nice is that we have the convenience of genre, right? We get fiction or poetry, and then you know you can go to school and learn how to do it specifically, and that makes it real easy to think about. Mm-hmm. If you're on the outside, I can think like, oh, that's a book of fiction, and that's a book of poetry. Mm-hmm. You said that you teach, yes. Mm-hmm. So how would you teach this book, if you would at all, mm-hmm. To a poetry class? How would you teach this to a fiction class? Or where would you even put it in the pantheon of academia?
Well, I would never teach my own work, but if I could, if I would, because you know, ego freedom, you know, I just teach your own book that might be on the ego side, you know. If I were to teach this, I can tell you this, when I taught literature, I'm not allowed to teach literature in a lot of places because I don't have a PhD, but I was allowed to teach it I was allowed to teach it at Bennington College, and I taught a class called Black Horror and Afrofuturism. And so paired with that were also pieces of scholarship. So they had to read Mama's Babies, Papa's Maybe, Hortense Spillers, which is not easy. They had to read Venus in Two Acts, Idea Hartman. So we were reading different black philosophies, theories, theoretical approaches. The way I taught fiction was not as just creative writing, but as a theoretical approach. I teach creative writing as theory, as sociology, as et cetera. Because the person who, especially if it's a one-to-one, like a black person's writing a black story that has black characters, and that might even be within their lived moment, their contemporary moment or whatever. But even when it's research, there's a way that we have access to the material in a way that no one else could do it if they were to have black characters. So in there is already a sociological lean to the creation of that fiction or that poetry. So I would teach ours as, yes, a novel that has theoretical leanings. How do we better understand freedom based off this text? How do you relate to freedom differently after having read the novel? What are some of the ways that we can differently understand slavery? And the thing is that it's not to conflate this as history, because it's not as imagined, but it's imagined based off of research and that kind of, what is critical fabulation? You know, if we don't have the information, then how can we fill in the blanks? And there's a lot of information that we don't have about that period because it was either not documented or it was destroyed. And to do that responsibly still requires there to be that one foot already in the door. Mm-hmm. And I think this book, if I can say so myself, has both feet in the door, and I'm trying to put my whole body, I'm leaning my whole body into it. So I would teach it like that. I would teach it as a very serious creative text with a theoretical framework.
I would teach it as a class on Black surrealism.
Yeah.
Doing the same thing you just said.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming out
thank
tonight,
so
guys.
Much.
Please feel free to meet Philip in the vestibule to get your
book
signed.
Book.
Buy a book. Get your book signed. And thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight. See you soon.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.